So talk to a little bit tonight about urgency. Part of talking about this is personal. As I mentioned in the post today, my father, who's 80 and a bit, has been ill for some time and has just made the decision to go into hospice. And so we're entering that final phase of his life. Thank you for sending the love. We don't know how long it'll be, as it is with such things, but I'm, you know, in the way that is often true in moments like this, there's all sorts of feelings, including, you know, sadness at impending loss and the loss that has already happened in the course of the illness, and some happiness or satisfaction that they're shifting into comfort and ease being the purpose of intervention rather than causing more discomfort in the service of an imagined fixing of the body. So you know, in the Dharma traditions, in Buddhism, we talk about death all the time, really. Like, it's at the heart of the whole thing. The Buddha saying over and over, you know, remember old age, remember sickness, remember death, remember loss. There's a beautiful discourse that I brought in the writing today, where involves the Buddha's close friend, who was named Pasenadi, who's the king of Kosala, of the kingdom that the Buddha lived in. And they became friends early on in the Buddha's ministry. And King Pasenadi was a great supporter of the Buddha, really venerated him. There's one discourse that almost entirely just consists of the king who has come back from a battle somewhere, that was needed to be done. He accomplished his aim, he comes back, he immediately goes to find the Buddha and just falls to his feet, covering his feet in kisses and praising him. And the Buddha says, you know, great king, what's the meaning of this? And the king just showers these kind of praises upon the Buddha. You know, is just clearly so happy to see him, his friend, his teacher. So there's a discourse with King Pasenadi where he's sitting listening to a talk with the Buddha, and someone comes up and whispers in his ear that his wife, Queen Malika, has died, and he just collapses, you know, with grief. Sitting there, right in the middle of the Dhamma talk, and the Buddha, you know, sees this and doesn't even have to ask, of course, what has happened, and says, you know, great king, there are these five things that cannot be avoided by anyone, they are these: that someone liable to old age should not grow old. That someone liable to sickness should not get sick, that someone liable to death should not die, that someone liable to ending should not end, that someone liable to perishing should not perish. And the teaching in relation to these is partly, you know, in an interesting way, pragmatic, and the way Bhikkhu Sujato, whose translations are often, you know, a bit casual in their tone, translates this. There's a poem at the end one of the discourses that gives this list, and it says, sorrowing and lamenting doesn't do even a little bit of good. When they know that you're sad, your enemies are encouraged. When an astute person doesn't waver in the face of adversity, as they are able to assess what's beneficial, their enemies suffer, seeing that their normal expression doesn't change. I don't interpret this to say that grieving is not appropriate, but to recognize that obsessing, it really says, like, you know, lamenting, sorrow and lamenting. Lamenting, a beautiful old-fashioned way to say complaining, I think. Complaining doesn't do a bit of good. And you can remember that he's talking to the king here, you know, when your enemies see that you're sad, they rejoice. You can't think clearly when you're in a state like this. And so there's the sense that with wisdom, there's an understanding that, you know, old age, sickness, and death come to everyone, and that when one knows this, there's a kind of even temperament. There's a kind of resilience, really, would be the modern word to say. There's a kind of resilience that one has, because our grieving for someone, you know, authentic, good grieving, an expression of love and care and connection, isn't weighed down or made anxious by a kind of complaint that things shouldn't be this way. Things should be this way. This is how things are anyway, or should isn't the right, you know, term for them, but things are this way. And the text, you know, concludes also by saying, you know, here's the next verse in the little poem that ends it: chanting, recitations, fine sayings, charity, or traditions. If by means of any such things you benefit, then by all means keep doing them. Right? And a lot of those are what we do, in a way, in the process of grieving. You know, we sing together, we pray together, chants, recitations, fine sayings. We sing, we pray, we make little speeches, you know, we talk about the person. Charity or traditions, you know, we do things to honor them. We put their picture up, we wear certain clothing, we get together in certain ways. If these benefit you, then keep doing them. Here's the final verse. But if you understand that, quote, this good thing can't be had by me or by anyone else. In other words, this good thing, meaning like, oh, I wish my father wouldn't die, or I wish, you know, I wouldn't grow old or sick. If you understand that this is universal, that all beings suffer from this, then you should accept it without sorrowing, thinking, the karma is strong. What can I do now? The karma is strong. What can I do now? This is a really interesting phrase. In the text, it's put in quotation marks, like you've experienced loss, you know what's going on, you have some wisdom, so you are reflecting that this loss is what everyone experiences. Everyone will lose those we love, everyone will die, everyone will become sick and old. If you live long enough to become old, you'll be old. Reflecting on the universality of this, and that, you know, the special thing that you crave, you know, not to lose the one you love. No one can have this. There's the possibility of a profound acceptance. And then the phrase, the statement after that acceptance is touched, is the karma is strong. What can I do now? The karma is strong. One way we can understand this phrase, the karma is strong, is to, you know, that it points to the deep embeddedness that we experience with life itself. We are alive, we are of families, we are of cultures and communities and traditions and lineages and ancestries. And that means we are deeply embedded in this thing. And that's karma. That's karma, action, cause and effect, conditionality. We are here because reasons, right? We're here because some people made a baby at some point, you know? We're here because culture kept going through all the wars and tornadoes and earthquakes and all the rest. You know, we're here because. We're here because beings continued to want, to consume, right? To reproduce, to do that living thing, to rejoice in life. The karma of rejoicing in life is part of what led us to be here. And so the karma is strong, is a way of acknowledging or even bowing to the extraordinary conditions that have led to us being here amid all the sorrows and sufferings. And this is an acceptance phrase, right? The whole teaching says, you know, this is happening. There's no way around it. It happens to everyone. Therefore, you should practice a deep acceptance. And you express that acceptance by saying, the karma is strong, right? I'm not separate from conditions. I'm not separate from my family, from my ancestry, from the history of the colonial project, from the great religions, from race as a construct, from money, from sexuality, from interaction and violence and love and beauty and art and celebration and the natural world and the human world, which are not separate at all. I'm not separate from any of this. It's all the karmic field that I find myself in. And that is a strong field. You know, that's not weak gravity where you could float away from it. You don't float away from that very easily. You don't become liberated from karma very easily. If you had noticed, Buddhas don't arise that often. You know, fully liberated beings, they're around. But, you know, this place is not crawling with them. Like, it's a bit of work to unbind the heart from such deep conditions and to continue living in a way where there's a profound freedom in relation to them, right? Because what happens when you get unbound, when you know, separate the heat of craving from the fuel of sensory engagement, and there's no more burning, no more, you know, constriction of wanting and disappointment. What happens when that link is severed, right? What we get described and what you might have glimpses of in practice is of a wildly different, but kind of very ordinary, subtle, totally different way of being, right? Like, it's still just you, but without any confusion about what to do next or how to relate to the world. And so then the phrase, the karma is strong, what can I do now? The karma is strong, what can I do now? The what can I do now, I read not as a statement of like doubt or confusion, which is usually how I say it. I'm like, what can I do now? Like, I don't know what to do. You know, it's not that. I think it's more like I have actually touched into a kind of acceptance of how deep the web goes that I'm embedded in. I'm not outside the matrix. I am in the web of all things. Matrix, by the way, doesn't mean the great computer, doesn't mean the AI. The matrix or the matrika is the same word as mother in Sanskrit. And so the matrix is actually the mother fabric of all things. And it's patterned and it's coherent. And so we are of that matrix, the great mother fabric, the matrika, which is also the language. The Sanskritic languages come out in a beautiful grid, a matrix of syllables. So we are of that web of meaning. We grok that a bit, we connect with that. The karma is strong, I'm really in that. And then what can I do now? This amazing alchemy happens where I accept my place in the order of things. And I do this partly by setting down or practicing setting down or suggesting to myself that I might one day be ready to set down the constriction of heart around losing those I love, around death and loss. I say, oh, this happens to everyone. Knowing this, I'm not going to let it consume my being with complaint. I'm going to recognize. And then what can I do now is the question more of the liberated heart. You know, while I'm still alive, I'm unbound from grief in a certain way. I can grieve but not be crushed by wishing things were otherwise. And now there's all this energy freed up. For what? You know, what do you do once your energy's freed up? Anything you want. So then, you know, what do bodhisattvas do? Well, they liberate beings by realizing there are no beings to be liberated. You know, they participate without grasping. They give extraordinary charity, you know, dana, great gifts of their time, their energy, their care, their resources, without any constriction in the heart, because they don't take anything personally. So at one point, King Pasenadi, the Buddha's friend, comes to him in the middle of the day, and the Buddha says, "What's up, King? Coming to visit me in the middle of the day? Like, what's going on?" And Pasenadi says, "Oh, I was just at a meeting of a bunch of kings and royal people, you know, people who do things that royal people do, addicted to sensual pleasures, seeking power, doing all the stuff of kingship, you know, what I do." And the Buddha says, "You know, great king, imagine that one of your advisors came to you and said, 'Sir, sir, from the east, there is coming a great mountain, a huge mountain rolling across the plain, crushing everything in its path.' And another advisor came from the north and said, 'Great king, there's a great mountain rolling in from the north, crushing everything in its path.' Another advisor, 'There's a great mountain rolling in from the west, crushing everything in its path. A great mountain is rushing in from the south, crushing everything in its path.'" In other words, you're doomed, right? There's no escape, no army can fight it off, right? The Buddha says, "Great king, what would you do?" And Pasenadi, who has faith, he says, "Well, in such a situation as that, what else would there be to do than practice the Dhamma? You know, to practice loving kindness, care for others, tend the heart, bring the mind to peace." The Buddha says, "Just so, great king, just so, old age, sickness, and death are like mountains rolling in from all sides, unavoidable, crushing everything in their path. What is there to do in the face of such mountains? Nothing, blessed one, nothing other than to practice the Dhamma, to practice the path, to be kind, to be compassionate, to care for others, to purify the heart, to clear the mind. What else is there to do?" I think one of the biggest challenges in our practice in the modern period is that we as a species, and particularly as a technologically advanced culture, are so powerful that we have not only, what's a good way to say it, kind of fucked things up, globally speaking, but also we have the idea that we can fix things that we've fucked up globally. And that's probably sort of partly true. There's a lot that can be done. That's great. And, you know, as some really good people say nowadays, it's not too late to do good things like that. But it makes practice into, it gives the realm of liberation practice a particular edge or twist to it, because we might fall into a certain kind of desperate hubris where we we might think that we can actually do something about those mountains crushing in on us from all sides. And there are some people who want to do something about that, you know, about living longer and longer. And certainly there are things that are important to do around, you know, disasters that humans have set in motion. And so the, you know, the simile or the fable becomes more complicated when it was humans who started rolling that mountain across the plains, crushing everything in its path. And now we're like, I think we can slow down that mountain. And we should. But that necessity might also distract us from the underlying deeper truth that the simile is pointing to. That no matter what we do or how much we save or how much we work, there's still this mountain rolling in from all sides, crushing everything in its path, and that no one avoids death and loss. And so we have this task of keeping our eyes on deep reality, you know, on the reality of death and loss, even as we commit ourselves to working hard to ameliorating some of the harm, some of the quickening of death and loss that humans have set into motion. And that can feel like a paradox sometimes. We have so much power. We might feel like I'm not quite ready to accept death and loss because there's so much we can do to forestall it or soften its blow. I think it's hard to become passionate about liberation if we don't really respect death as finality. Right? If we are able to distract ourselves with pleasures, that's the classic way to not think about death and loss, is to just keep the sugar coming, you know, keep the beautiful people moving across the stage. But the Buddha cuts right into that delusion when the king comes to visit and the king says, "Oh, I'm doing all those things that kings do. You know, I'm busy." And the Buddha's like, "Yeah, remember what's really going on." And so we can update the parable in a certain way to say, you know, oh, there's a mountain rolling in from all sides, crushing everything in its path. You know, one of those mountains is that, you know, the climate is shifting, partly as a result of human activity, very much as a result of human activity. And some amount of that shift is amenable to steering, right? Things can be done. And some of it is set in motion now. And so, great king, what is there to do? Nothing but practice the Dhamma, clarify the heart, clear the mind. That doesn't mean don't act, right? Like always, always, always remember that practice the Dhamma doesn't mean an acceptance. This is always the thing with acceptance. Acceptance doesn't mean give up and don't do anything. Acceptance means energy devoted to complaining doesn't go anywhere else. And so if we want to act with compassion and a certain amount of power, as bodhisattvas do, we actually need to not waste our energy in non-acceptance, right? Spinning our energy in wishing things were otherwise. It just takes us away from what's actually happening. So, on the personal front, I went to visit my dad yesterday afternoon, and one of the results of the combination of cancers and stroke that he's had and various treatments is that he doesn't speak any longer. For several years, he hasn't had a voice to speak. And so he has to type messages into his phone, and a little robot voice speaks. He's a quantum physicist, and he worked at the Livermore Laboratory, essentially with his office on top of a nuclear reactor for 50 years. And one of his heroes was Stephen Hawking. So I was teasing him a little bit about, you know, he's a little too dressed up like his hero for my taste, speaking through a little robot voice. But he's also getting quite tired and doesn't really like typing on his little phone, because who does? And so now I go to see him, and you know, I ask him questions about, I want to hear how he's doing, and I want to tell him about how we're doing and all that. And then he just slowly picks up his phone and very slowly, kind of one letter at a time, types out a message, and I wait, and I look at the paintings on the wall, and I just hold his hand, or I put my hand on his knee while he's typing. And then the little robot voice says, "I love you, Sean," in a kind of flat monotone. And that's pretty much the only thing he's typed to me the last four visits I've been to him over the last few months. And I'm like, oh yeah, you know, the mountain is bearing down on you. And you don't even really have the energy to say much. So then what else is there to say? You just say the important thing. You know, well, blessed one, what else to do? What would you do but practice the Dhamma? You know, bring kindness and compassion into the heart, clear the mind. I wrote today in the writing about urgency, and in a way, urgency is the teaching that's right on the other side of this whole thing about acceptance, right? Where the instruction is, find a kind of profound acceptance so that you can live in the world with a different kind of heart and presence. And the thing about urgency is that that's the practice, right? To find that profound acceptance and presence. But you know, the mountains are rolling in from all sides, and they're not going as slowly as you might wish. And so urgency is actually the recognition that practice takes some effort, and you only have an unknown amount of time to do it in. You know, you have whatever health and youth and comfort and resources you have, and here come the mountains of loss. And so urgency, traditionally, in a funny paradox with like the thing I'm trying to do is just like relax into presence and intimacy with what is. Urgency is like, yeah, but can you do that yet? And how much time do you have to figure out how? And so urgency is this term, samvega in Pali, that is a kind of spiritual urgency or passionate engagement with practice. And it's a quality in the heart that is not the same as grasping or anxiety or wanting things to be different. It's not self-criticism. It's not like, I wish I was further along the path. That's just complaining. Samvega is like, what's here now? You know, the karma is strong. What can I do now? You know, here I am sitting with my dad. It's a big moment. Oh, the karma is strong. What can I do now? You know, well, I love you too, Dad. You know, like, what else are you going to say? The karma is strong. What can I do now? Like, oh, I'm tired, but it's time to work, or it's time to be with my kid, or it's time to, you know, come and talk about death and urgency. It's okay. You know, the karma is strong. I'm embedded in the whole thing. What can I do now? And so, you know, urgency and acceptance are just like hand in glove. It takes work to unbind the heart from the profound complaint that it's learned. And that work is the work of the path. It doesn't have to feel onerous, but at times it does. because, and I'll just keep saying it, it's the refrain for the karma is strong, right? The karma is strong. You gotta engage. And if you don't engage, that's okay, right? It's okay. Oh, I can't do it. You know, I'm gonna let myself wash down the river of Netflix for the evening. Nope, it's okay. It's okay. The karma is strong, you know. The current is strong. At any point you can, you know, in the middle of the current, wake up a little and be like, oh, there's sensual pleasure in watching this story unfold, and I'm a little outside of the struggle, the grief, whether that's okay. It's like, oh, here I am, you know, the karma is strong. What can I do now? I can leave it on, I can turn it off, you know, go get some tea, say hi to my friend, text my dad, you know. So, urgency without constriction, without anxiety. It's okay, you know, that the mountains are rolling in from all sides. They've always been rolling in. And while they've been rolling in, you know, every generation, people are like, let's make some art, you know, let's make some babies. Let's, you know, let's make an organization and fight the power. Do all of the things. The mountains are rolling in. So, all right. Stopping there for now. Thank you. Thanks for your care for the personal side of the story.